a thing I've sort of been on a mission of in the last few years is debunking the myth of the starving, depressed artist, because I think we all make better work when we're fed well. And I don't think there's any reason why an artist shouldn't make a good living.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and I'm pleased to share my conversation with Canadian potter and teacher Naomi Clement. She received her MFA from Louisiana State University and her BFA from Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University. She explores ideas of home and belonging through the powerful lens of functional ceramics, those we touch and use, and we talked about the importance of family. We also talked about making beautiful shapes, how she balances form and color, and some of the challenges she's experienced and overcome in her ceramics journey. I hope you enjoy this conversation with the great problem solver Naomi Clement. Check out our work at colorandceramics.com, and let's get over to the other side and enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Naomi, thanks very much for joining us today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. Really appreciate you being here.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, I really love your use of color and particularly how the dark clay really flows through the slips and the glaze and the underglaze that you use and to give it really such a rich design. And of course, I really like the texture as well. And you know, I must say, I really enjoy also your desire to explore the idea of family and food and home and belonging. Like, that really rings true for me. So I'm really looking forward to having a conversation about lots of those ideas.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I think a lot of folks don't, you know, they look at my pots and they see the visual aspects of them and the, you know, as you're saying, the color and the design and the texture and respond to that, which is great. I obviously love that, but there is a lot of meaning and intent and thought behind the work too. So it's always nice to get an opportunity to chat about that a bit.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I'm assuming that you have taken years of work to get to where you are today. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your journey to where you are today as an artist.
Yeah, well, how long do you have? It's certainly been a journey. When I give an artist talk, I always show images of my home growing up because I was really lucky in that I grew up in a home with a lot of art, and my parents weren't artists. My mom's a weaver, but they had a lot of friends who were artists, and so our walls were super colorful. We had a lot of art around us growing up, and pottery as well, and so I just sort of grew up in a really rich environment visually. So that I feel like that certainly influenced me, and then I went, but I never saw myself as artistic, you know, because I don't draw particularly well. Even after years in art school, sort of trying to learn to draw, and that's not my natural space. And so I never thought of myself as an artist because when I was younger, like the artist in the class was the person who could, you know, draw really well. That I ended up going to an arts high school in London, Ontario called H.B. Beale Secondary School, which sort of had a really well-known art program and kind of went into the art program in grade 11 on a whim. Essentially, like it was like that was the time you would enter it. I always enjoyed art classes, and they had a very sort of classic foundation program where you go through 2D design, 3D design, you know, and get introduced to all the different media, printmaking, drawing, paintings, and ceramics. And clay was one of the first things I think I'd ever done in my life that I had a bit of a natural ability for. And I think also, because I'd never actually been a very strong student in school, and so I knew how to work, and clay rewards people who know how to work. And so, all my fellow classmates who, were used to being the good artist because they could draw, all of a sudden didn't have that advantage anymore. And I had the advantage in that I knew how to work. And yeah, just sort of really enjoyed clay and that whole community around the art program. And then I went on to get my undergrad in ceramics, my BFA from the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax, which I think is now called NASCAD University. And then, yeah, and pursued clay there. It has a really rich ceramics history and program there under Walter Ostrom, who's now retired. And then I, apprenticed for a couple of potters, but got a little disillusioned after graduation. There weren't as many options in Canada then as there are now for young emerging folks in terms of residencies and the like. And I felt like I didn't know how to go about making a living. And so I took quite a hiatus from clay, about 10, 11 years, and pursued some other things. Worked in wine sales, worked in restaurants, worked in marketing, and then went through, it's a long story, but ended up deciding to go back and get my MFA in 2013. I'd sort of gotten back into clay a little earlier and had an opportunity to work on a family friend's farm in exchange for room and board and studio access. She was a potter as well, and sort of all of this work that I think was like pent up inside of me for the past 10 years just sort of came out, and I was like, no, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so dove back in sort of, feet first, into clay. And I guess that was in 2012, 2013, something like that. And kind of, haven't looked back since. And yeah, it's been done all sorts of different things. Went and got my MFA from Louisiana State University. It was a 3-year program and graduated in 2017, and then did some different residencies, travel all around the US, and then eventually settled back home in near home in Stratford, Ontario in January of 2020, just in time for a pandemic.
Yeah, that's cool. I've followed your history a little bit on the net and the Instagram and so on, and see that you've been doing some really cool stuff over the last little while. We sort of touched on this a little bit at the beginning around what might inspire you, and I'm really interested in what inspires people to do what they do. Right. Some of it's making a living, as you talked about, but for artists, it's more than just making a living. So, can you talk a little bit about what inspires you today, or even how that's transitioned over time?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I do focus a lot on the making a living part of it because I'm a, single self-employed person, and that's just the reality of it is that I need to make a living doing it. And in terms of what inspired me in the first place, I think it was just a joy of like connecting and an interest in visual language and sort of expressing myself through material. And also, I think there's something about clay that I love in that it's useful, and I enjoy being useful, I think, and making things that are a part of people's daily lives. And I guess, thinking back to having grown up in a home where I was surrounded by beautiful objects, which is not everyone's case growing up, and we did have handmade pottery that we used, and just sort of how much more rich it makes life, like daily life, when we sort of have a beautiful environment and beautiful objects to use, and objects that have been thoughtfully made and that have a story, and so I think that's a big impetus for me, is just sort of connecting with people and connecting with folks all around the world through, whether it be through the objects that I make, through the pots I make, and sort of becoming part of other people's daily life and story through objects of use. or through teaching and connecting with students all around the world, and you know, helping other artists. You know, now that sort of evolved into wanting to help other artists find their voice, and also, you know, find ways for to help them pursue their creative career and dreams with confidence. And also a thing I've sort of been on a mission of in the last few years is debunking the myth of the starving, depressed artist, because I think we all make better work when we're fed well. And I don't, you know, I don't think there's any reason why an artist shouldn't make a good living.
Absolutely.
So.
Cool. So, yes, your work is about functional work and pots we can use but there's another component for you, it sounds like, and that's connecting with people, and that relates to family stuff for you and your connection to new families around the world, I guess, in terms of people who are making their work. Can you talk a little bit about the family connection? I think that's real interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in, you know, I'm one of four kids. I'm the third of four. And family dinner was really important. Like, we always had family dinner every night at 6 p.m., you know, six people, sort of no exceptions. And it it always, you know, recounting it now, and it sounds like this kind of rigid thing. And there were definitely times when it was, but it was also a really beautiful kind of way to connect and sort of bear witness to each other's lives in this sort of day in, day out way. And I like that pots end up being part of that conversation too. You know, I think in terms of the family thing too, it's like, I've always been kind of I was always a lonely kid. And I think have spent, you know, not to be too depressing, but many years as a lonely person. And there's something beautiful about ceramics in that it does have this gorgeous sense of community, and vessels are about community as well, and sharing meals together, and sort of allow you to connect both with yourself and others, I think, in ways that can be really potent and powerful. Yeah, I think it was a lot about sort of trying to find my own identity and voice, both as a person and as an artist, and, you know, and in my family, and that kind of journey.
Very cool. I know that for me, often when I think about ceramics, I think about, you know, the visual component, right? That we look at the piece. But for me, it's about also touching and holding the piece. And I know your work. Here we are virtually talking, and I don't have a piece in front of me, but it really gives me the impression that I want to touch it and hold it. Is that important for you, or how does that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, and in this day and age where so much work is quote unquote consumed just by an image, you know, like whether it's on Instagram or on my website or things like that, it's sort of this 3D object is consumed in a two-dimensional way. And that's just, you know, the reality of our day and age. But my hope is always that the pots will, that I'll under promise and over deliver in terms of photographs, like that, you know, I want them to be nice and good representational photographs of the work, but that I always want the pots to delight and surprise in new ways in person. And there is, you know, the clay body that I use has this, when it's the bare clay itself fired to sort of like a hot cone 5, has this really sort of smooth, and I do spend a lot of time sanding and smoothing, but kind of polished stone feel to it that I really like, that interplay between the glossy ceramic surface and this sort of like polished stone surface as well, and that interplay both visually and tactilely as well.
Yeah, very cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about color and form and so on. And I guess there's always this interplay between the form and the surface design or the color. How do you think about that and work with that balance between the two?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an ongoing dance. As I said, I grew up in a home that was like really colorful. When my parents were collecting art, it was the 70s, and so it was like a lot of really bright primary colors. And walls, I often say, if I ever wanted to truly disappoint my parents, I'd live in a beige home. They would be like, "How did we fail her? Where did we go wrong?" So yeah, for me, like home and color are really kind of interconnected and entwined, and sort of like belonging and color as well. And so I think it's more just about having a color palette that allows me to explore that in different ways. And that's what I really liked. A lot of things really started coming together when I found the current clay body that I use, because I wanted the clay itself to have a voice in the conversation, like a visual color. And I tried a lot of different things over the years. But what I like about the clay body that I use now, it's this really rich chocolate brown stoneware that it responds well to both warm and cool colors equally well. Like a lot of the mid-range darker clays are kind of more orangey, that sort of don't do as well with some of the colors. And so this chocolate brown has this just really nice richness to it that provides sort of, I think of it as a can, as a ground color. Like, painters will often put down a ground color, on the whole
Sure.
canvas that they then lay all their color on top of. So the colors that I use are fairly bright primary colors. They're all like the color aspect of my work is largely underglazes, amico velvet underglazes. And if I were to use those on a white clay, it's just a completely different thing. It's almost like really garish, very like the circus came to town kind of thing. But that chocolate brown kind of interacts and responds with the colors and deepens them, enriches them, and sort of has a nice voice in the conversation. And so I think it's largely about that sort of that interplay and dynamic.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody will ask, what kind of clay is that? So, can you
Yeah.
share what that is?
Yeah, for sure. It's standard 266 stoneware. So it's out of the US. It's difficult to get for me here in Canada because there's no suppliers in Canada. Luckily, I live close enough to the border that I can, when I go down, I can pick some up. But it's kind of high. It's a high maintenance clay. A lot of the darker mid-range clays can be a little high maintenance, just in terms of not for building. It's great. It's nice and plastic. It's a great clay for construction, but it can be high maintenance in terms of firing and glazing. So it's not one that I recommend for folks who don't have access to their own kiln or control of their own firings.
Yeah, do you have to put it in the kiln in a slow fire or a slow cool down or?
Yeah, a bit of both. It's quite a long bisque, and if people are using dark clays and having issues, I do share those my firing schedules on my website, naomiclement.com. I think that's under the process page. You can download them. Yeah, it's sort of like burnout during certain stages where a lot of the so it's a hotter bisque to burn out some of that organic material in the bisque stage, so it's not burning out in the glaze and then like sort of causing pinhole bubbling issues. And it is along a slow cool on the glaze as well. And it's also, I think they've changed it. The clay used to be rated cone 4 to 6, but if you actually fire it to a true cone 6, it will start to bloat. So I fire it to it's basically like a cone 5.5, essentially, a hot cone 5. And it can't be refired. Like if I have a piece that's been glaze fired, and then there's some kind of, say, flaw or something that I want to, touch up with some glaze, if I try and refire it, it bloats. The clay just doesn't like to be refired. So again, as I said, it's a bit finicky, it's high maintenance, but it's sure is a beautiful, luscious clay when it all said and done. So
Well, sometimes that's what happens when something's luscious. It's also finicky, right? And you just got to go with that. Yeah, very cool. Now, so you've got this rich brown, reddish clay. How do you select your color palette that you use with underglazes?
I sort of have two color palettes that I use, like a warmer color palette, reds, orange, yellows, and then a darker, like cooler color palette, blues and greens. Some of it again is just through playing and investigating and developing a color palette language that I enjoy. Some of it is also dictated a bit by the clay. Like there are certain underglazes that the clay just doesn't respond because it's such a dark clay. Like some of the more pastel-y, like I've tried to work with like a lighter green, or certain certain yellows, pastel-y yellows. They just don't. They get either completely like washed out by the dark clay, or they respond poorly to it in terms of like bubbling and the like. So it's partly dictated by the clay. And just, colors that that I really respond to, a lot of primary colors for sure. And colors that just sort of resonate with me.
So it's kind of a combination of you knowing technically what really works well with the clay, experimenting and finding out what doesn't work and what kind of colors just maybe fade away, and also what really is important to you, what you love and like, right? Because that's pretty critical, isn't it?
Definitely,
You know, one
definitely.
of the things we've talked about with other guests on the show has been the notion that it's really important to do things that you love, not necessarily only things that people will buy. And that's an interesting balance to take, because if you're like you and you want to make a living at it, people need to purchase your work. And at the same time, you need to do things that you love. How does that fit for you?
Yeah, I think it's a constant dance, and it's certainly something I think about a lot and talk with other artists about, and my students as well. It's like, as soon as you sell something, it changes your relationship to the object. Like as soon as you're making work to sell it, it just changes some of your decisions, and it's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. It just sort of is what it is. I certainly try not to. I try and make things that I want to make, but again, it's sort of a complicated dance. Like because of where I live, I sell when I sell my work, I sell it largely online, like through my online shop. I love making really big things, but those are a pain in the ass to ship. Like a big platter is one. It's just like really expensive and just really precarious to ship something big and flat. And so those tend to not be things that I make as much because they're a challenge to ship versus if I was someone who had a shop, like my own shop, perhaps like it would be different. So yeah, and if I just listened to what people wanted all the time, I would just make mugs 24/7. And I love using mugs. I buy other potters' mugs. I totally get why people love mugs, but I don't want to be a mug making machine. So yeah, it's sort of that. It's a constant dance, and sometimes you have to step back and reassess or change tack, and sometimes you just have the realities of deadlines and things that you have to kind of make work for. So.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, what I mean, we've talked a little bit about some challenges you've had, like with choosing this type of clay you use and so on. But can you talk about a challenge that you experienced as an artist and how you overcame that?
I mean, I think the biggest challenge Oh, I can think of a couple. Just trying to decide which tack to take. One was just like owning that I am an artist. That took a really long time. I think I resisted being an artist for a very long time. I'm a bit of a inspirational quote magpie. I collect them, and one of my favorites is, "The only thing harder than being an artist is not being an artist." And as I said, I tried for a very long time not to be an artist. And then just sort of realizing, like, I'm an intelligent, capable woman. I could go and be a doctor or a lawyer if I wanted to, but that doesn't interest me. So surely I'm intelligent enough to figure out how to make this work, in terms of make a living at it too. So I think that's been the other challenge for me, is like figuring out how to make a living at it. And when I went to grad school, certainly part of my thinking was, oh well, I'll have a graduate degree, and I can teach at the post-secondary level. No, I knew that those jobs were very difficult to come by, but just it was certainly sort of a thought in the back of my mind, and I tried to get those, one of those jobs for a while. And I was also older when I went to graduate school, and just didn't want to move. I'd moved around for a long time. I didn't want to keep moving and, following jobs, and instead just decided to kind of plant a flag in the sand and be in one spot and try and make that work. And the timing ended up being both really fortunate and really difficult in terms of, when I moved, got my place in late 2019, December 2019, and moved in January of 2020. It was great timing in that I had a home, and had sort of decided after many years of moving around that I was just going to pick one spot to be in and try and make it work from there. And I had my whole year kind of lined up, teaching workshops, selling at Enseca, like all of these different things. And and that takes a long time to set that all up, and felt like, okay, I can make a go of this, maybe get a part-time job somewhere else to help subsidize things, rent a room in my house, all of those things, to try and cobble it together. And then COVID happened, and everything was just canceled overnight, that I'd spent so long working for. And it was, yeah, really, and I had a mortgage to pay. It was really scary, and terrifying. And it was sort of like, well, either I go get a job at the grocery store or I figure this out. And I was very fortunate to be in Canada, where we had a lot of support from the government. Like, we had the CERB, the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, or something like that, which was for self-employed. They opened that up to self-employed people, because I was self-employed, I didn't have any, employment insurance or any unemployment insurance, that kind of thing. And so I was able to get that, and I was able to actually pause my mortgage payments for 6 months. They just, everything, they were very responsive, which I'm very grateful for. And then I had sort of seen other people doing virtual workshops and was like, well, I don't have the infrastructure to do that. Like, I don't have an online sales plat I didn't have an online sales platform at that point in time, because I was mostly selling my work in person at workshops. So not only was the workshop income gone, but the direct sales income was gone as well. And I didn't have an online platform for that yet. And I ended up partnering with an organization that I'd been a resident artist at in California, Sonoma Ceramics. They were like, hey, do you want to do some online workshops with us? And I was like, yeah, great, awesome. And they handled all the admin and the booking side of things, and I did the teaching, and those went really well. And luckily I had an audience already on Instagram that I was able to sort of help drive sales to that. And so it was sort of, proof of concept that this is a viable thing, both financially and also, I've got some ability at it. I enjoy doing it. I had teaching experience that I was able to translate to this new format. Certainly if 5 years ago you'd have told me that I would be teaching ceramics virtually, I would have thought you were insane. Like, how is this going to translate to a virtual medium? And then I just sort of, grew things from there. It kind of opened up a whole new way of making a living. And yeah, it's been really rewarding. And also reaching students, all over the world. So
You're a great problem solver, it sounds like. And it sounds like that's really a skill set that you brought to make your artistic career successful.
I guess so. And it's funny because, folks will say, "Oh, wow, you really pivoted really well and worked so hard," and which I'm certainly grateful for that feedback and that other people recognize that. But I think at the time I was just like, felt like I didn't have any other option. Like I just needed to figure it out. And as I said, luckily had the support of, some government support in order to get my feet and take the time to build the business and sort of do it incrementally. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So this is a great segue into telling us a little bit about your school, because I think that's a big part of what you're doing these days. So can you tell us a little bit about your school?
So I teach all sorts of, as I said, it sort of started with, how to workshops, like how to make a cup, hand build a cup, hand build bowls, like my surface techniques, layered surfaces, all of that stuff. It sort of started there. And I enjoyed that aspect of it. They're generally taught live over Zoom, and then I sell the recordings afterwards. But sort of something that I was seeing and experiencing myself and like getting feedback from other students was just, being a studio artist, like everyone has this dream to like have a studio in your home. But it can be really lonely creatively. Like I spend a lot of time by myself in my studio, and it's such a different thing from the community studio experience that many of us is how many of us get introduced to clay, like taking a clay class at a community studio or going to school for it, where you're surrounded by other people and different energy. And it's also hard to advance your work in a vacuum, kind of. And so I started offering different things from just the instructional, like pottery techniques workshops. I started offering, I run a longer intensive mentorship program called Finding Your Voice for, it's like a small group cohort, 8 to 10 students generally, in the winter, who are, that's by application, people like wanting to dig into the why of their work. I have another sort of mentorship light program called Finding Focus, which is like strategies for artists to sort of dig into some of the questions behind their work. And then about a year and a half ago, I started a membership program. So that's like a monthly sort of cost for people to be a member. It's called Maker's Spark. And they get, access to all of my pottery techniques workshops, like so the whole catalog of workshops. We bring in guest artists. Just last week, I had my friend Shalaya Marsh for a workshop on screen printing with ceramics, and then there's a community aspect as well. Like we have conversation, we have a Q&A session every month, private Facebook group for sort of community connection. And it's funny. I was talking to a friend, and it's like I basically built the teaching job that I wanted. In that, yeah, I get to connect with makers from like all over the world and talk about pots, which is, what, and art, which is what I love doing, and help other artists kind of find their way. And I also teach some a professional development course too called Professional Practices, sort of, helping, I think of it as like a boot camp for artists in terms of like all the professional stuff I wish I'd known when I first started out, like social media, websites, applying to shows, all pricing work, all of that stuff. And so, yeah, it's been really rewarding, to get to help and connect with students from all over. And As I said, kind of build the teaching job that I wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like Naomi University in lots of ways. And I think one of the things that I hear that's been really important to you and that you sense in others is this notion of community, of being able to connect with other people on a personal level, but also on an artistic level, to just find out about techniques and ideas and struggles that we all have.
I think it, as I said, it, and through my teaching prior to the pandemic, at all sorts of different community studios and the like, when I'd come in to teach workshops, I saw a lot of people who were hungry for more. Like they wanted more than just the how-to. They wanted some stuff around the why and the ideas behind our work. And so that's sort of what I offer, both in the longer mentorship program and also in the membership. We do like creative book clubs. We do critiques sometimes in the membership, and show and tells, all sorts of things to sort of dig a little deeper with the work.
Awesome. And we'll make sure to put up links on our post and so and such for people to be able to find you and your school, because that would be pretty important.
It's everything sort of on my website, naomiclement.com, is sort of the hub for all of it. But yeah, that'd be great.
So I want to leave with one question, and that is, what kind of advice might you have for an emerging ceramic artist? If you could give them one nugget, as I call it, what would that be?
It's hard to narrow it down to just one. It's probably a really boring sound, feel, sounds like a boring piece of advice, but it's take care of your body because it's your most important tool. And if we want to have like long and healthy careers, many of us start in clay when we're younger and have bodies that sort of bounce back very quickly.
Yeah.
And I certainly, I'm not old by any means, but in my mid-40s, and things, you don't bounce back in the same way, and injuries and unfortunate ways of doing things, and they start to add up and catch up with you. And I want to have a long and healthy career, and so like building in sort of maintaining my most important tool, which is my body, I think is essential if you want to have a long and fruitful career.
Perfect. Great advice. Hey, Naomi, thanks so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Oh yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, it's always nice to talk about this kind of stuff.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.